The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, again, you're coming from a CNBC interview. And, you know, the question, as simple as it sounds, they continue to prod you and say, David, how high gold? How high gold? And, you know, you seem to shift things the other direction and look at currencies whenever that question's asked. I wonder how many people understand that.
Kevin, the primary question that was being asked was if the Swiss franc is no longer an option as a safe haven because of the recent devaluation of the currency, overnight devaluation, and commitment to a euro peg at 1.2 or less.
So what that means is they actually locked the currency onto every time the euro drops or rises. The Swiss franc does exactly the same thing, just at 1.2.
That would be the maximum price that they would allow on the upside. Of course, they would accept a much lower price as well. But, Kevin, that was the question, is if the Swiss franc is no longer an option as a safe haven,
right,
where do we go? And I said, well, listen, there's really two issues in play. First of all, there is the question of liquidity. If that is what is paramount to an investor, if that is the primary issue, a liquidity driven crisis, then you have people go to treasuries, 2, 5, 10-year treasuries, or very short dated into the 30, 60, 90 day paper markets. Or you have, and you've seen this 2008 as well as presently, people buying German bonds,
right,
short term denominated German bonds. The reason why they go there, Kevin, is because there's depth in the market. What I mean by that is you can have many, many investors come in with trillions of dollars and see very little impact in terms of the bid and ask spread on those assets. So they're very deep. They can accommodate a huge influx of capital without being pressured higher or lower in terms of price. So that depth of market is very critical for the liquidity concern.
So if it's a liquidity concern, that's one thing. Now, the second concern would be what?
A solvency concern.
Okay.
And this is in stark contrast to 2008, where certainly you had institutions which were facing solvency issues as a result of not having liquidity lines.
But not governments.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What we saw happen was governments stepped in and used their balance sheets to solve the crisis and take away the solvency issue as a systemic issue.
Right.
And so what we have now, Kevin, is balance sheets, central bank balance sheets, which have already taken it on the chin and are worse for the wear after 3 years. And now the question is, liquidity concerns or solvency concerns? Where will capital flow if it's concerned over one issue versus the other?
So let me ask you the question that CNBC asked. Isn't $1,900 too much to pay for gold?
Well, my response was this. It has more to do with the direction of currencies than it does supply and demand for the metal.
Right.
Certainly, supply and demand for the metal will take the price of gold higher or lower on a given day. And I think that trajectory is probably another $1,000, $1,500 higher. So, yes, on a short-term, 2-3 year basis, I see the price of gold moving higher.
That's just supply and demand. This has nothing to do with currencies.
Exactly.
Right.
But why did gold, in Swiss franc terms, see a significant jump in price Tuesday of this week?
Well, clearly, it's the devaluation of the currency, Dave. That's what happens. Gold is a constant. The currency is not.
Well, and exactly. So a one-day drop down between 8 and 10% on the Swiss franc, and the price of gold moves higher. Was that on the basis of more people coming into the gold market? No, it was just reflecting a devalued currency. So the question is, what is in the mind of the Swiss National Bankers moving forward? What is in the mind of the ECB moving forward? What is in the mind of the Fed moving forward? If you can tell me what a Bernanke or a Tremonti or anyone else who's in this world of financial creativity is going to do with their currency, then I can tell you what the price of gold might be.
Well, and we know what's in their mind because Bernanke's already written about it, okay? The European Central Bank has already had to do it, even though they said they didn't do it. And Germany's going to be voting on that. We're going to have to talk about that, too. But So we know they're going to print money. That's what they do. The problem is, even if it's in their mind to print money, how much control are they going to have when the inflation actually starts to hit?
Well, that's where the market does dictate how much appetite there is for paper money at a given point in time. What I thought was really interesting, Kevin, with the devaluation of the Swiss franc and the change in policy, I mean, they used to say, we're not going to increase M3 money supply by more than 3% a year. And they've been perceived as a hard currency.
Right.
Why? Because it's been over a decade since they walked away from having a huge gold backing for their currency. They've essentially lived off the legacy of the 1970s, in which they were primarily gold-backed.
If you ask a person today, is the Swiss franc gold-backed?
Well, yeah,
a lot of people still think it is.
And so they have adopted monetary policies which imply stability, which imply discipline, the kinds of stability and discipline that would have been implicit to gold backing for that currency in an earlier generation. The gold backing's gone. They have maintained some of the disciplines.
Right.
The disciplines, as of this week,
just about gone.
Are gone. And so investors ask the question, where do I go? If I don't like dollars, if I don't like German-denominated euro bonds, where do I go?
Well, David, all this currency devaluation that's going on, it's what we've called competitive currency devaluation, too. The Swiss obviously had to devalue because they no longer were competitive in the marketplace. I mean, it was costing so much more to buy Swiss products because the euro had devalued, the dollars devalued. So what do you do as a government when your currency is too valuable?
And you saw the market respond as it should.
Right.
To the currency devaluation, you saw a nearly 5% jump in the increase of the Swiss stock market. These are companies that have seen their exports become very, very inaccessible to their European markets. As the Swiss franc has been rising, things like chocolate bars and watches, and of course they make a lot more in Switzerland than just those things, but it's more and more expensive.
Well, Dave, it reminds me, you know, what's going on right now with these devaluations, it's like putting a Band-Aid on something that really they're trying to hide, because in reality, there is a gross error that's occurring in Europe right now. These guys are looking for this recovery. They're thinking, if we just do this temporarily, we're going to get back to that growth that we've had. But the error seems to be that growth was fueled by the debt they can't pay right now. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. Every scenario aimed at resolving the crisis in Europe, Kevin, has assumed a strong economic recovery.
Right.
That was a part of an increase in revenues, an increase in the growth dynamic. And so, yes, they would cut back a little bit in spending here and adjust this and that variable. But an underlying assumption for every one of their scenarios has been a robust economic recovery,
which in the past has been fueled by debt.
Yeah, this is the built-in frailty to the plans attempted thus far, or the ones that are awaiting in the wings for implementation. Repeated bailout attempts in Greece, this has illustrated a degree of misunderstanding on the part of central planners. They're still, as you suggested, Kevin, they're still crediting themselves with record growth. The growth that we've seen in the last few decades,
right.
They're not seeing the critical role that expanding credit over the same period of time played in those growth dynamics.
So now,
in the context of credit contraction, their efforts are frustrated, and they're moving from one stopgap measure to the next, applying the same quote-unquote brilliance they did before. Kevin, there's so many versions of conceit which are ultimately debilitating. This one proves fatal for Europe to some degree, and certainly for investors if they're not paying attention to it. The credit cycle has changed.
Well, an issue with this credit cycle changing, you know, they continue to try to throw money at this, but they're also saying austerity. They're saying we're going to tighten things up. We're going to be able to pay our bills. Some of the issues going on in Europe right now, David, are on the austerity side. I mean, these Italian protests, what we've seen in Greece, I mean, there's violence that's also coming up from below.
Kevin, the euro issues to date, I think, are precursor to crisis. Not to minimize the severity of either the financial or the social dislocations we've seen thus far, but the combination of austerity-driven political discontent, which you described in Italy, and the monetary policy price destabilizations which we're seeing, Kevin, these will become more acute in the future than even what we see in the present tense.
So, David, to what degree do these things really threaten the euro project?
Well, I think we're dealing with nothing short of an existential threat to the Euro project. And I'm not talking about sort of the existential philosophical movement where we're all of a sudden going to see everyone across Europe smoking cigarettes, chain smoking cigarettes and drinking espresso, considering their navels about, you know, how dark and noir the whole world is around them.
This is a little more serious.
Existential as in game over, no more. And Kevin, the ECB will orchestrate all that it can via monetary policy. And this is the key thing to recognize. They need to stimulate growth. They need to jumpstart the financial markets. And they're having to consider this because of the negative feedback they're getting on the austerity measures already suggested.
Right.
So I expect to see more financial sector mergers. And this is very similar to what we saw in the United States in the heart of the U.S. subprime crisis a few years ago. Politicians in Europe are treating this like it's a cross-border skirmish and not as an all-out war. They're underestimating the gravity of the circumstance.
You know, David, it reminds me when you say that of those old westerns, that stereotypical scene where you had, you know, a few cowboys fighting a few Indians, and it looks like one side's winning, and then all of a sudden, from horizon to horizon, up on the hilltop, is, you know, 10,000 Indians ready to go. And I think the politicians right now think, like you're saying, they're fighting a skirmish. You hear this day-to-day type of thing. You even hear it here in the United States. This assumption that, hey, if we just fix it a little bit now, we'll bend the rules just a little bit now, we're going to win this war and we're going to be back to the way it felt 5 years ago.
And there's a very shallow appreciation, Kevin, in that analysis for how grave the threat is to the European Union as it exists today. Not that it won't exist in some form tomorrow, but I think the markets are going to get this. They're going to realize this first before the politicians do.
Right.
Again, that sort of echoes that theme of conceit. Kevin, no politician, no bureaucratic henchman that's sort of already written their heroic obituary or see themselves etched forever in the history books wants to be undone at this point.
Sure.
They're committed to a memory of their former greatness. They're committed to a project that was visional in the beginning and now is a nightmare, but they're not seeing it as a nightmare. They're still committed to that old idea.
Well, David, even the ones who see what's actually happening, you know, some probably saw this coming from the beginning. I have to think back to the interview with Otmar Issing. He knew that there were problems in the surrounding countries, in the extremities, but he also probably knew that there would be a consolidation at some point, you know, just a pulling in of power and possibly getting rid of the extremities.
Right. So when we describe an existential threat, what we're talking about is an end of the EU project as we know it,
right,
which is really just to say a consolidation, that ultimately we'll see a consolidation amongst a few key players. Kevin, it's a little bit like the human body on a cold day. You've got centralized blood flow to the core to keep the vital organs functioning. And yes, it's at the expense of ever colder fingers or toes or what have you.
Sure.
But the periphery is expendable while keeping the vital organs alive and healthy, regardless of the pain involved, is critical. There's a key differentiation there.
Sure, the body knows to save the brain, the heart, the liver, the lungs. Those are the things you save, even if you lose an arm. Now, I hate to say that Portugal's an arm, or Italy's an arm, or Spain's an arm,
but Estonia is like a toe. I mean, it's one toe that you can probably do without.
Dave, what comes from Estonia?
Oh, the export market from Estonia? You weren't aware?
Getting serious here for a second, because people are trying to figure out in the short term what's going to happen. I mean, what can Europe do right now to placate people?
Yeah.
Is there something they can do?
Well, via the ECB, Europe can lower rates to close the gap between dollar debt rates. We're practicing the zero interest rate policy. They may, in fact, do something very similar and close the gap between dollar debt rates and euro-denominated debt.
Mm.
But here's the issue, Kevin. In doing that, they'll have to neglect the Taylor rule. We've talked about this on the program before, but the Taylor rule suggests where rates should be in light of inflation.
Okay, and just an aside, I've had several calls, Dave, from the DVD where the triangle is being presented and there's a blackboard, you know, we're talking about the triangle. And underneath is this complicated little formula. That's the Taylor rule.
It's a shorthand version of the Taylor rule.
Which says what?
Essentially, the Taylor rule tells you where rates should be in light of the prevailing inflation.
Right,
so
just to have a positive rate of return.
Exactly.
Right.
So yep. U.S. rates are 2.5%, according to the Taylor rule, U.S. rates are currently 2.5% to 3% under the mark. So taking into account inflation, current day inflation, we should see interest rates a good 250 to 300 basis points higher, according to Taylor rules, the feedback you get from that. So, I mean, in reality, it's U.S. rates that need to come up, not euro rates that need to come down.
Isn't that a strange adjustment?
Well,
so in other words, they're adjusting to us. Switzerland is adjusting to Europe. It's like the dominoes are falling.
Right, but it's all monetary authorities are reluctant to raise rates. And you know, quite the opposite. They're encouraged to lower rate structures so as to support growth and subsidize their respective economies via suppression of those borrowing costs. So they're trying to stimulate a flailing or a stumbling about economy. And this is, the EU now has the freedom to do that. Inflation expectations have ebbed here in the last few weeks, and concerns about a double dip have reemerged. So they have the political cover, the ECB does, to now lower rates again.
Well, and David, there's also just the whole element of the voting populace. Okay, let's face it. If you're a voter and you, a little bit of inflation is going to help you in the short run, they're going to give it to you versus get voted out.
The longer austerity measures are entertained or implemented, the greater the political pressure will be brought against central banks to eliminate those austerity measures and substitute some form of monetary policy measures, whether it is lowering interest rates or, you know, putting together some sort of a spending initiative. Nobody ever says where the money's going to come from for a spending initiative. We've got that announced coming up this week, Thursday. Obama's going to tell us how he's going to solve the economy by new shovel-ready jobs. This didn't work 2 years ago.
Right.
We still have unemployment issues. In fact, they're worse than they were, but don't worry about the details.
But he gives a darn good speech. As long as the teleprompter's working, he gives a darn good speech.
And the question is, how much shock can he bring to the listening audience?
Right.
Is it a trillion? Is it 2 trillion? Is it 3 trillion? Is it 10 trillion? I mean, I'm being facetious, but he's got to throw out a number that communicates to the market that we're basically going back to the 1930s-style jobs programs, the work programs, where we're building dams, we're putting in new roads, we're doing all of these things. And a certainly scrubbed version of history says that that aided in our recovery in the 1930s. I say scrubbed because it had nothing to do with our recovery. It certainly kept there from being mischief on the streets.
Right.
But that's crowd control. That's not job growth. That's not a return to a healthy economy.
But we have been taught that. Now, Germany has been taught some very tough lessons over the last century. And this is one of the things that's come down the pike here on this European situation, is that Germany really does play a key role at this point, do they not, in the votes that they take in their court.
Our belief is that the Euro project will, in fact, be considerably stronger over the coming years as the region shrugs off the weak participants and consolidates around a relatively healthy core. I mean, the currency volatility alongside the political volatility will be entertaining, if not a little bit unnerving.
Sure.
But through this process, I think we'll find a robust set of participants deeply committed to a common European vision and with the ability to fund themselves, not via subsidies from other countries, but from within, from their own global trade. Kevin, this is an effort that's deeply supported by the powerful elite within Europe and the moneyed interests from Asia and the Middle East. What we're watching, Kevin, is the U.S. currency monopoly being broken. It's no longer tolerable. And keeping a second player alive is vital to these other global interests. While they may say gold as a part of our reserve assets is important, they're not going to raise gold to a similar position, Kevin, as they would, say, yen or euros or what have you. It may play some small bit part in the future, but this is the point. Kevin, you've got the moneyed and powered interests throughout Asia and the Middle East,
sure,
who want to break that dollar monopoly.
They don't want it just to be dollar anymore.
And so if it costs them something to maintain the Euro project and support the Euro project, that cost is an acceptable cost. It's an acceptable loss because they're facing the similar sort of loss or a similar sort of loss on their dollar holdings as it is. Better to get a quote-unquote healthier system. That's not necessarily to the betterment of the U.S. system or the U.S. dollar, but for the rest of the world, that certainly is the view.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com. You know, this makes me think of why China, for the last few years, we've talked about China sitting on an awful lot of dollars. But China actually has been sending quite a bit of money into this European problem. And it seems like that probably is a very good investment for them to use their excess liquidity for right now. But, you know, We have also talked about, in fact, you know, all through history, crisis is actually a way of propelling what the elite would like to have happen forward. I'm thinking of 2008, David. We saw a tremendous crisis. We saw a lot of things that a lot of people didn't expect, even though, I hate to say it, it was pretty plain that it was coming. But we're seeing consolidations. The bankers' bonuses never really went down. A lot of money's been printed since then. We've had thousands of pages of regulation that really don't change anything printed. We're edging closer to a 2008 crisis right now, are we not, in Europe and worldwide?
We are, and I think the focus is a combination of liquidity and solvency concerns, Kevin. Liquidity is the easier one to solve. There's some easy places to go, as we started the conversation today and mentioned, whether that's treasuries or German bonds. But very different than 2008 are the solvency concerns.
Right.
And I think this is where we begin to see sort of a Darwinian fitness test. Who amongst the banks in Europe are going to survive and thrive, and who will simply go the way of the dodo bird? Banks are leading on the downside in Europe. If you look at European trade, stock markets there, banks are being decimated.
A little like we saw in 2008.
Absolutely. Yeah. Since the end of July, Kevin, we've seen about $7 trillion in equity values which have disappeared. Spain and Italy, they're only faring well due to the ECB monetization of debt. In the case of Italy, Kevin, market manipulation of the sort has brought borrowing rates from 6.2% down to 5%. Mm. And of course, these are short-term fixes. But elsewhere you see, you know, Dexia, a large Belgian bank, their CEO jumped ship this week. Anticipate. Listen. If you're not listening, engage. Consolidation across the
right.
European bank sector will take the place of recapitalizations. That's the big question, is can they force recapitalizations? Christine Lagarde at the IMF has said, yes, we need recapitalizations of these banks. Who's going to put money into them?
Sure. It's like Wachovia. Wachovia went right into Wells Fargo.
Right.
And we saw this with Merrill as well.
And, I mean, we saw Buffett very heroically, you know, with the green mask and green cape, save the day, or try to attempt to save the day, with B of A and his $5 billion purchase of preferred stock. Kevin, you realize he's got a $3 billion guarantee on that? I mean, so he's actually only got $2 billion in play. I'm on 6%. That puts his real rate of return double digit. If you looked at the things that happened that week, Kevin, he is at the center of Washington and Wall Street corruptions. The Oracle of Omaha is going to ultimately be dragged through the streets, tarred and feathered, as the devil from Omaha, would be my guess. If people knew the details of the deals that he's penning, they would know that people were signing contracts with the devil.
Okay, now.
I realize this is controversial. He's one of the brightest investors of our era.
Dave, many of our listeners have read the books about investing just like Buffett. Unfortunately, they don't have the information that Buffett has.
Well, just like they didn't have the information that Mr. Paulson had either when he was going short the most toxic part of the subprime market, and he actually got to put those pieces of paper together. He structured the deal, said, here, you go and buy it. He didn't tell anyone that he was going to be selling it short. It was a fabrication. Was it brilliance or was it a fabrication? Entirely clever. You have to give him that. But brilliant investing, or just a manipulation of securities laws where he couldn't get touched and be thrown in jail, but essentially was manipulating circumstances to his benefit?
Well, and speaking of a manipulation of securities laws, you know, let's face it, the banks would be bankrupt right now if they valued the assets on their books for what they're actually valued at. These guys are doing just fine because they don't have to do that.
Kevin, I think this goes back to the point of recapitalization. It's much more probable to see massive consolidation across the European bank sector than it is a recapitalization, because people aren't willing to give them money. Raising capital in today's environment?
Right.
No, sir. Not at all. Not on your life. But Kevin, if there are surviving entities, you know, 12 to 18 months you've got as a free pass in terms of the time. Once you've consolidated two entities, you've got to consolidate operations, you've got to consolidate balance sheets, you've got to consolidate income statements, and you know, you basically are pushing forward any other negative disclosures on impaired assets.
Right.
It's almost like a bankruptcy without a bankruptcy, a timeout in the middle of the game to allow for there to be some clear thinking before you re-engage in the play. play. And in this case, it's not a bankruptcy with all of the unintended consequences of that. It's just a straight purchase of assets. So whether that's in French banks, German banks, Belgian banks, you're going to see the same kind of consolidation there that you saw here in the U.S., would be my guess.
But you're still just pushing the problem forward.
Exactly. Well, and the only thing that facilitates that, because again, we're talking about the avoidance of disclosure on impaired assets.
Right.
That's the mark to make believe, which is the primary reason, next to record low rates, that banks have fared well in the 2010, early 2011 period and going forward. No one is counting assets at present values. If there was an actual capital impairment, Kevin, and a forced recapitalization, you would see a number of these bank institutions found insolvent instantly. Kevin, we're watching in real time something that ultimately will want to be a controlled event. The market is going to determine who survives and who doesn't in the European banking industry. Before the market determines, you're going to see some matchmaking and perhaps a few shotgun weddings to where someone else is determining who survives and towards what end.
Well, it's because, again, there's voters out there. Now, the voters could be the market, or the voters could actually be just German constituents.
Well, yeah, over the weekend, that's, I think, what you're alluding to. Merkel's party, Angela Merkel in Germany, her party and her coalition lost elections in her home state, bringing it to a total of 6 losses this year.
Now, she's played 6 games, and she's lost 6 times so far. That's right. Not a great series.
Well, in baseball, 3 strikes, you're out. This is 6 strikes.
And she's still in.
And she's still in.
Right.
Yeah, so, but Kevin, these are German states that had previously voted for her coalition.
Mm.
I mean, we suggested months ago.
So she was an incumbent in these states, basically.
Exactly. It was a few months ago that we suggested these state elections were really the canary in the mine, telling the German elite that this sort of pan-European vision was of less interest to them than simply a German vision of future job growth, prosperity. The taxpayers were sending a message. The voters were sending a message. We don't care about being Europeans as much as we do
about being Germans.
Prosperous,
yeah.
A prosperous society, family, community, state, country, you know, in a smaller context, we care about us. And the bigger picture of this pan-European union, not so much a priority for us. That's what she's had to deal with, Kevin.
David, this is just one more occasion where the politicians are disconnected, like you were talking about. They're thinking it's a skirmish when really it's a war. You know, they're treating it like it's a bridge loan that they can just take for a short period of time, and then everything will be better, and they'll own the new house.
Yeah, normalcy shall return. We just have to buy ourselves some time. Stress will dissipate.
But David, the judiciary in Germany still has a say, and they're voting today.
Well, that's right, Kevin. The judicial decision on the constitutionality of the European bailouts is today. Unfortunately, this is not so much a reading of the Constitution by scholars interested in its meaning, the meaning of the Constitution or its implied intent. It is a geopolitical negotiation, which is interesting to see the judiciary sort of negotiating something for this pan.
So who are they negotiating with? Are they negotiating with the rest of Europe, basically?
Yeah, I think the courts will angle for more influence and control for the German parliament in the Eurozone. And this, you know, I think they will give their approval. They will give approval to get expanded power. And so, yes, Germany has some upside by approving the bailouts, even if there's political ramifications. It just means that they've got to put some lines in the sand and say, listen, here's what we find abhorrent and wrong. They have to take a very scolding and harsh tone so that it's you know, it gives themselves some political cover. Yes, we're approving them, however, and then they'll give their list of expectations and requirements.
Well, and doesn't it apply to some of the violations of the Maastricht Treaty?
Yeah, the critical factors which I think are being ignored, Article 104B of the Maastricht Treaty, which states this, the community shall not be liable for or assume the commitments of central banks, regional, local, or other public authorities, end quote. The ECB is expressly limited from fiscal support, Kevin. They cannot provide support to individual countries. Every country still has to raise their own revenue, pay their own way.
Yeah, but they've been buying bonds, Dave.
Exactly. And those bond purchases arguably are just such a prohibited activity. So that's the question. That's what's in play in the courts is, are we stepping all over our laws? I mean, there's over 100 lawsuits arguing that the bailouts are in direct conflict with what's called German basic law. Only about 15 of those claims, Kevin, are being heard by the German court.
Right.
The last thing I'd mention on that is that the primary function of the ECB was to be price stabilizer. And I think that would be in question if they were to assume the role of lender of last resort or sort of the euro guarantor. And that's what they're quickly moving towards becoming, which calls into question what the protocols are that they're supposed to operate in light of.
Well, and David, we've read the book When Money Dies. We've looked back at the German inflations in the past. Some of these people still remember the horrible inflation. And Bundesbank is a good example right now of somebody who says, what are you doing?
Right. That huge disconnect between the ECB and the Bundesbank is that the Bundesbank remains in favor of the no bailout clause. And they are concerned about long-term credibility. They are concerned about currency stability. Those are the issues that are near and dear to the Bundesbank heart, to anthropomorphize. But that's, I think, something that the ECB now is being pressured. You know, again, the question of how does the EU survive? Who are the constituent parts? And do they want to be the ones essentially shooting the wounded dog? This is where, from a political standpoint, they do need to buy time. And if they want to see a healthy dissolution, it needs to be on the prerogative and at the inspiration of those member states who say, no, thank you, we don't want to be a part. If they're construed as being kicked out, there's some very negative political or geopolitical ramifications.
Well, David, for the listener who's listening to this, the problems in Europe, the problems in America, you've got to have a place to go with your money. I mean, are you going to be in the dollar? Are you going to be in the euro, the Swiss franc? We know that our clients and our listeners are in gold. We hope by now they are. But what about the currencies?
I think the dollar's been given every opportunity to rally. The euro has levitated quite well in the context of European chaos, and these two have been in a very close trading range for many months now. Both relatively stable, though both relatively or absolutely weak. Kevin, is a very difficult question. I think those trends may reverse with the euro temporarily going lower, which creates problems for the Swiss yet again. They'll be forced to devalue even more. We may see the dollar go higher, if only by a few points. But adding 5 or 10 points, Kevin, I think would be a reasonable expectation or outcome given the stresses and strains in the market. Again, this goes back to the question of what is being emphasized in the market. What's the point of concern? As a market practitioner or as an individual investor out there listening, if your concerns are about liquidity, then the dollar should see some play as the treasury market should see some play as well.
Right.
If your concern is more about solvency, then you may see some flow into treasuries and German bonds, but you'll also see some flow into the metals markets as well. Again, solvency being the primary concern, solvency and counterparty risk, something that people are trying to insure against more and more. So, Kevin, will the Swiss franc peg give further support to the euro? I mean, to some degree it will, as any depreciation in the euro would widen the gap to the franc and force the hand of the central bank to be buying euros and selling Swiss francs. So to some degree, the announcement this week by the SNB will be euro supportive, but we'll have to see.
Okay. David, you're just returning over the last couple of weeks from South America. And so that we're not completely myopic, just looking at Europe, looking at America, there are the BRIC countries, and there have been amazing gains and sometimes amazing losses in the BRIC countries. And so, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and actually some of the other unnamed countries that aren't part of the acronym. What's your thought on that?
Kevin, I would think it's a mistake to think of these four countries as a whole. Each of these countries is moving in light of its own strengths and weaknesses, and we are sort of clustering them because of the Goldman acronym BRIC, and it's easy to think about them as emerging countries and countries that share some similar thematics. But as we discussed a few weeks ago with Alexander Landia, there's unique components within the Russian market. They can't pay their bills completely. They're running in the red if
sure.
oil's not above $115, $120 a barrel. So they have their own set of issues. Kevin, Brazil has its own set of issues. Certainly a success story today. If you look at the banking industry, it's your Brazilian banks that are carrying pretty high market caps compared to your European and even U.S. banks. India of the four would be the one that I'm probably most encouraged by long term, but they need to seek some major reforms, bankruptcy reforms. What I mean by bankruptcy reforms in India is this. Kevin, there's companies that have existed for 24 years, 25 years, 30 years, and never produced a thing in India. And they've carried employees of anywhere from 100 to 2,000
employees.
That sounds
like our government.
Yeah, well, they show up. They can play cards, they can do whatever they want, and they're paid, and they eat in a canteen. But the bankruptcy laws in India are such that an enterprise that's no longer an enterprise. In other words, a company that's not making money anymore, you can fold the company, but that doesn't mean you can fire the employees. We're talking here about state-owned enterprises, Kevin. State-owned enterprises that should have been destroyed, disbanded, gone the way of the dodo bird long, long ago. These inefficiencies are allowed to be carried within the Indian marketplace because bankruptcy code is not supportive of a restart. Certainly the U.S., this is where we probably have the greatest advantage of anyone in the world. An entrepreneur can start and fail and start and fail and start and fail, and then talk about running for presidency. That's the story of a Donald Trump and the story of a great comb-over and a story of a great start-over. I mean, you know, the bankruptcy code is really helpful in some instances. India would see a new lease on life if they could get a hold of their corruption, if they could rein in their bankruptcy code. There's some structural things that need to change. Okay, that's India. China. Massive problems in China, Kevin. Massive problems. And I think we've talked about those ad infinitum.
Part of it is the real estate bubble.
Right. I'm getting closer to a steak dinner with my dad because I think China, you know, my favorite leading indicator in China is off 50% in the last year.
Yeah. For those who don't remember the bet, this was, what, about 6-8 weeks ago, your dad bet you a steak dinner that China was going to be the next great place. And it was going to happen soon. And you were like, no.
No. And I've already picked out the place.
it's in Beijing, probably, right?
That's not a bad idea. Oh, my.
It'd be a cheaper steak if you're right.
Well, well, Kevin, I think investors are being reminded that with the possibility of higher returns, this is, again, going back to those BRIC countries, with the possibility of higher returns comes the absolute certainty of higher volatility and lower liquidity. And so that's where you're seeing some of these countries certainly off 10, 18, 30% in the last year. You have to have a catalyst for growth. If the catalyst isn't there, as much as the demographic story is supportive, as much as the long-term story in terms of population growth is supportive, these things take a long, long time to develop. I wouldn't be betting on any of them today, perhaps with the exception of India.
Volatility feels great on the upside and terrible on the downside. But we also have governments and government decisions that come in sometimes with volatility. Just look at yesterday. When you're making a lot of money, that feels good. But when it goes down 30 or 50%, it feels horrible. Now, David, the New York Stock Exchange invoked something yesterday, rule number 48, which basically allows them to just shut down the exchange and open it quietly. Rule number 48, the first two paragraphs are probably worth listening to because a lot of listeners who have money in the markets don't realize that at some point, if things get too volatile, they don't have liquidity. They can't get in or out.
Yeah, well, and it's described as arranging for the fair and orderly opening or reopening following a market-wide halt of the trading at the exchange. That's the way it reads, Kevin.
Right.
And it goes on to say that the exchange, absent relief, the operation of the exchange is likely to be impaired. A qualified exchange officer may declare an extreme market volatility condition with respect to trading on or through the facilities of the exchange. In other words, you invoke Rule 48, it's a timeout.
You're done. We're not trading. I remember when China shut down their markets for a week back in 1987 because it was just too volatile.
It's a little bit like huge traffic across a freeway, and if you could stop time and freeze frame, then you could look around and say, okay, is there a point where there's going to be a break here and we can re-engage? And then they count and decide which companies they're going to open trade with and sort of do a soft start, if you will, and reintroduce volume back into the exchange, but on an orderly and controlled basis.
And that happened yesterday. Okay, David, coming full circle, the CNBC interview was asking, is gold and silver in a bubble? Again, each time you're interviewed by what I would consider just sort of mainstream media, they continually want to prod you and make you say things that would be bubble-esque, a little bit like the bubble that we had with the real estate market or the bubble that we had with tech stocks. I'm going to ask you again, is gold and silver in a bubble? Is this bubble mentality?
I think George Soros' comments a year or so ago were accurate. Gold will be, and I would put emphasis on those two words, will be the greatest bubble I think we've ever seen. Is it there now? No, it's not. Kevin, I would encourage any of our listeners to just take a casual poll amongst their friends, family members, work colleagues, and see how many out of a group of 10, out of a group of 15, you determine the sample size. have a significant stake, 3, 5, 10% of their liquid assets or more in the physical metals today. I think you'll find that very, very few people are participating. And again, Kevin, I think this is where we are on the cusp of moving into the third phase. The third phase for me is that final phase. It could last 2, 3, even 4 years where we see blow-off dynamics, not unlike what we saw in the technology arena circa 1996 to 2000. You already had top calling then. You had Greenspan step in and say, listen, you look at the market moves to this point, and there is irrational exuberance in the equity markets.
Right.
And yet, from 96, we saw 97, 98, 99. We plugged higher and higher and
higher. Until March of 2000.
In that final stage. So I think we are on the cusp of that final stage if we haven't entered into it. But yes, the easy money has been made. The big moves are still ahead. I would encourage our listeners to crystallize their questions. We're coming into the fall season. Each year, we take questions and spend 1, if not 2 weeks, looking at your questions. What's on your mind? What are your primary concerns?
And David, that's one of the most fascinating times of the year for me, because listening to the questions of people who listen on a weekly basis and process and re-listen. We've got people who call in and who've re-listened and taken pages of notes. It's very humbling when you hear that. But it's fascinating because these people are engaged and they're asking questions that really need to be heard by more than just themselves.
Yeah, we want to review your concerns. We want to review your interests. We want to view the questions, the things that we may have discussed that need further elaboration. If it's on your mind, pen it down, send us an email, and we'll look at addressing that along with everyone else's here in the coming weeks.
Well, and how about the DVD? I mean, there may still be people listening right now that haven't seen the DVD.
Yeah, we've sent out tens of thousands of copies already. If you haven't gotten a physical copy and you'd like to, you can order that at our office. Call 1-800-525-9556 or go online and request it. You can also download it online. Just go to McIlvaney.com and you can navigate around to find it there.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or, like David said, give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.